This season of the year has always been a difficult one for Jews, especially for Jews, or probably uniquely for Jews who live in Christian countries. One day I'm going to bring my tape recorder. Even here, dispense with the whole thing. Now, the Roman calendar began the new year in January. It was a two-headed god, Janus, that looked both ways. Backwards to the previous year and forward to the coming year. In fact, most of the months that we have were from Roman times, and you have Roman emperors that named months after themselves, like Julius Caesar named July and Augustus Caesar named August. So this was a Roman calendar. The Romans were pagans, and as part of the celebration of the new year, it was a pagan holiday. The Gemara in Avodah Zorah already lists it, that there was an eight-day pagan holiday, meaning that it began December 25th. And the eight-day pagan holiday resembled sacrifices to the deities, the orgies of food and physical pleasure. It was a so the Gemara calls it Kalandia, from the Greek from the Latin word calendar, the same word, and that it was an eight-day festivity. Because of that, the Talmud, the Jews were forbidden not just to participate in it, but the Jews were forbidden to even commercially engage in any sort of business transaction associated with the holidays. So it was like an eight-day vacation for the Jews. And because we were never allowed to be seen as promoters of paganism in any form, so the Jews stay away from it. But this was a major, major holiday and period of time in the Roman calendar and in the Roman Empire. When Christianity took over the Roman Empire in the 4th century, the Christian church was faced with many great dilemmas as to how much it should accommodate itself to the beliefs and practices and customs of its potential constituency. And since the constituency was pagan, so people that, you know, on Tuesday worshipped 100 gods, Wednesday you came and told them they're Christians because you sprinkled them with water, that doesn't automatically work, right? And therefore, in order to accommodate itself to the pagan world, to the Roman world, the Christians adopted many of the holidays of the pagan world, except they now gave them a Christian twist to them. And if it's too warm, maybe you need to turn on the air conditioner or open the windows. Doing both will not accomplish anything. The church therefore adopted this 8-day period. The 8-day period of the pagan holiday, December 25th to January 1st, was adopted by the church as being part of the Christian calendar. And there arose this legend of the fact that the Christian Savior was born on December 25th, even though a close reading of the New Testament makes it quite obvious that they believed that he was born in the springtime. And mentions about the census undertaken by Herod the Great. Well, that census never took place in the middle of the winter. Nevertheless, that became the birth date of Jesus in the Christian mind. And therefore, the eighth day, so to speak, became the anniversary of his circumcision. And it was New Year's. It was the beginning of the new year, the change in the calendar that pushed the year forward. Now, the Jews who bitterly rejected Christianity, in fact, the question arose whether or not Christianity should be considered as paganism or as monotheism. There was a great difference in practical behavior, because if it were considered paganism, then the Jews couldn't have any commercial dealings within this period of time with the non-Jewish world. And for instance, Maimonides and most of the Sephardic scholars regard Christianity as a form of paganism, especially Roman Catholicism, and especially the Greek Orthodox Church, which is replete with icons and statues and all sorts of things. There was no Protestant church at that time, but the adoption of all of these things, the Rambam says explicitly that they are pagans, and that it is paganism. I don't want you to misunderstand me, but the Rambam had the good fortune of living in a Muslim society, in a Muslim world. The Muslims always considered the Christians pagan, as they do today. And therefore, his opinion and his rulings really had no practical effect on the society where he was in Fostad, in Cairo. So it had no practical effect because there were almost no Christians living there, and he was at the time of the Crusades, when the Christians were certainly at odds with the Muslims, etc. So that was his opinion. That opinion was not adopted by the Ashkenazic Jews who lived in the Christian countries, especially in France and Germany, where the main Ashkenazic group lived in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries until they were expelled and made their way east to Poland, Lithuania, Bohemia, Hungary, etc. There's a Tosfos in Maseches Avodah Zarah that discusses this, and Rabbeinu Tam, who is the leading Tosafist and the grandson of Rashi and really the strong man of the Jewish people in his time, in the 12th century, very, very wealthy person, very great scholar. He was held to be a holy man. His name was Yaakov, and they called him Tam, based upon the description of our father Jacob in the Chumash, Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Oholim. Blowing hot air?
Yeah.
I thought that's me. Right. But the simple reason Yaakov is because of his name was Yaakov. In any event, Rabbeinu Tam was the main decisor of Jewish questions in his time. And he said that Christianity is not paganism, it is imperfect monotheism. Imperfect monotheism is called in Hebrew shituf. Shituf means like a partnership. It's God plus something. So Christianity is God plus, you know, plus Jesus, plus the Holy Spirit, plus Mary, plus the whole gang. But basically it's still a monotheistic form of worship. And he said, and this is the way the Shulchan Aruch also decides the matter, that in the non-Jewish world, shituf is considered, even though it's imperfect monotheism, but it is not considered to be paganism. And therefore, in line with that, Ashkenazic Jewry always dealt with the non-Jewish society around them, whether it be in money, whether it be in goods, whether it be in food, whether it be in wine, etc., during the period of the non-Jewish holidays. And in fact, they supported their decision by saying that if we don't do it, they will hate us more, they will persecute us more, and therefore, because of that, we are almost forced to accommodate their wishes, and that became the basic behavior pattern of Ashkenazic Jewry throughout the ages. Now, a calendar item, which exists both in the Talmud and later in the general world. The Talmud itself brings two opinions as to how to figure the solar calendar. One opinion is that of Mar Shmuel, the great rabbi of Nahardoya, 3rd century Nahardoya in Babylonia, who said that the solar year is 365 days long, and we should figure it on the basis of it being 365 days. The second opinion in the Talmud, which is more exact, is that of Rabbi Ado bar Ahava, who said that the solar year is 365 and a quarter days long, which is almost correct. It's really 365 and 5 hours and 55 minutes and some number of seconds. And it's based on 365 and a quarter days. And we, in reconciling the lunar calendar to the solar calendar, use this second 365 and a quarter day count. Now, the church took over the Roman calendar, which only was 365 days. So in the middle of the 16th century, the Pope woke up to the fact that the calendar was way off. In fact, then it was off 11 days because there was no accounting for the quarter day. And they wanted to have it accurate to the time of the birth of Christianity. So the Pope, whose name was Gregory, in the middle of the 16th century, skipped 11 days. So like, you know, today was October 4th and tomorrow was October 15th.
Which century is this in?
16th century. The old calendar, which was established by a pope by the name of Julian, established in the 4th century, so that was the Julian calendar. So the difference between the Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar, 11 days approximately. Now, the Eastern Church, the Slavic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, all kept the Julian calendar because they didn't want to give in to the sovereignty of the Roman Catholic Pope in Rome. And therefore they said, you're not going to tell us to change the calendar. But Western Europe, which was under the, if not the control, but certainly the great influence of the Roman Catholic Church, changed to the Gregorian calendar. The difference is, what day is Christmas or what day is New Year's? Christmas, according to the Julian calendar, now became January 6th. And the new year began January 17th. Since the Jews lived by now in Slavic countries, as well as in Roman Catholic countries, so then the question arose in Jewish custom also, when was Christmas? Now, why should the Jews care when Christmas is? Because of the fact that there's a custom that was mentioned by Tosfos already. It's a custom only for Ashkenazic Jews. Sephardim never heard of the custom. And the custom was that on the night of Christmas, on Christmas Eve, they didn't learn Torah until midnight. They would not study Torah. All of the study halls were closed. All of the synagogues were closed. There was nobody. And in fact, as a byproduct of this custom, the custom was to play cards until midnight. It's a strange custom, but it's a custom that is rooted deep in the Jewish psyche. So then the question arose, which day, which night is Christmas? Which night don't we learn Torah until midnight? Is it January 6th or is it December 25th? And we have a whole literature on this. And that night and day was called by the Jews Nitl. In Yiddish they called it Nittel Nacht, the night of Nittel. Now, where does the word Nittel come from? So the simple and real explanation is that it's from the Latin word which has to do with birth, natal, right? Which has to do with being born. Neonatal units in the hospital, right? But Jews don't like that, if you know. That doesn't appeal to us if you give a simple answer. And so they looked for other reasons why it was called Nittel. So one reason is because Nittel also means to be hung. So it referred to the execution of the Christian Savior. So to a certain extent it was a tongue-in-cheek reference. Others say that the word Nittel means that it was removed, that it's something to be removed that has no value. But it was called Nittel always, Nittel Nacht, and they didn't study that night. All of the commentators, since we know that the study of Torah is paramount, it pushes away almost everything. The Talmud says, for instance, that in Rabbi Akiva's yeshiva, they would only stop the official learning time Erev Pesach and Erev Yom Kippur. That was it. And in later yeshivas, in Voloshin, for instance, my grandfather told me that they had shifts so that someone would always be learning in the Beit HaMidrash, and that they even had people that, for instance, when Yom Kippur was over and everybody went to eat or something, they had a choice cadre of 10, 12 students that remained in the Beit Midrash and studied Torah until the others finished eating. Then the others came to learn, and they spelled them, and then they could go to eat. But that was like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There always was someone learning. And this concept of learning Torah is so paramount in the Jewish mind that it really takes center stage on everything. That's why you have people that, for instance, come to a wedding and they come with a Gemara and they sit down and they learn. So in another society, we would consider that rude. In our society, that's well understood. Especially since the Chatan and Kala have not come out for an hour and a half, and you know, and nothing's happening, and so you sit down and learn. Because again, the concept of studying Torah combined with the concept of not wasting time. Time is the most valuable commodity. It's the only thing in life that is not replaceable. And because of that, therefore, the Talmud places a great emphasis upon not wasting time. It's interesting that the English idiom for it is to kill time, because it's murder. Because time is a gift. And you have to be industrious. You have to do something with the time that you have. You can't just kill time. So all of this together raised the question, so here they took off a night of learning. For what? On what basis? So there enters into the picture a number of interesting things. The main reason, again, just like the main reason for why it was called Nittel is from the Latin word natal, so the same reasoning, simple reasoning was, it was dangerous for Jews to be out on the street on Christmas Eve. In a Christian society, in the Middle Ages, where Jewish life meant nothing, where it was easily taken, so therefore that Jews should have to walk to the synagogue or walk home or walk to the study hall or even be congregated together in one place was felt to be very dangerous. What was midnight? Why was the witching hour the cutoff point? Because of the fact of midnight mass. in all the Christian countries. Today we live in a world where the Christians aren't really observant anymore. They're not frum. They're all off a course. So therefore, today it became, Harrods and Bloomingdale's and all sorts of other things, right? But and you keep on hearing over and over again in Christian circles the plea to restore Christ into Christmas, to somehow bring it back to be a religious holiday, because it no longer is a religious holiday. It's a national holiday. It's pretty much a secular holiday. And it's pretty much just a shopping holiday. I mean, that's really what's evolved. In the United States, in certain industries, 70% of all sales occur during the Christmas season. So, it has departed a long way from its original source. And this is something that has happened basically in the last 80 years. And we'll talk about it, that the Jews created this. And the Jews, more than anyone else, have commercialized Christmas. And the Jews have, all the great movies about Christmas were made by Jews in Hollywood. And the great, the national anthem of America, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, is written by a Jew. And all of the, the Jews took it over and they pretty much they pretty much took the religion out of it. So it became reindeer and snow and shopping and all of these things, but not here. So, but in the Middle Ages, midnight mass was midnight mass. And the church had a tremendous control, hold over people. People who were actually afraid that they were going to go to hell. And therefore, until midnight, it was very dangerous to be out on the street. Midnight, they were all in the church, etc. So then, the Jews had a chance to sneak out to go to their study halls. And so then that became the custom. That was the origin of the custom, was based simply on safety and security on the night of Christmas. Yes?
So if the origin was security, then why should there at all be discussion over when it's really Christmas? So it shouldn't matter. It should be whenever the place you are in is celebrating it.
You're 100% right. But now I'm going to show you where you're wrong. So we're going to move it up one here now. One idea that was advanced. These are all discussed in the works of the great rabbis, the Chassam Sofer and others discuss it. What happened over the last 200, 250 years is that the ideas of the Hasidim, of the Hasidic world, took hold in the Ashkenazic world. The Hasidic world is based, it's a Kabbalistic world. It's not based upon rational or logical explanations. It's always explanations that have to do with a spiritual world that we cannot see, but nevertheless is present, nevertheless influences us completely. And therefore, in the Kabbalistic world, they saw great dangers in learning that night. Not dangers from the non-Jewish society, which, for instance, let's say in our time and in many countries, it's not really that kind of a problem. But they saw in it this great Kabbalistic world, a world of all sorts of spiritual problems that can occur. And they said, because that night has been sanctified so much by the non-Jewish world, by the Christian world, So they've released into the world on that night such great forces that even studying Torah, we would be contaminated by those sources. And therefore, until midnight, we don't study Torah. So then they asked, well, what's the deal with midnight? So then they answered as follows. All of the non-Jewish world is in church at midnight. And the Jews are where? Home sleeping? In other words, if all the non-Jewish world can get up and stay up and come to midnight mass, then where, so to speak, are the people of the book? We're God's chosen people. They're in bed. So therefore, they said, if the church is conducting midnight mass, then we're going to conduct midnight study. And that became the bookends for the time that they didn't study in the first part of the night because of these Kabbalistic reasons, but they did study from midnight till morning because of the fact that they did not want to appear, so to speak, inferior to the sacrifice of the Christians who are willing to get up in the middle of the night and are willing to go to midnight mass and we should be sleeping, etc. Now, this custom of not studying on the night of Christmas. So the point that you made is an excellent point. It would depend where you're at. But if you look at it in the Kabbalistic world doesn't depend on how where you're at. The Kabbalistic world looks to see when these forces were really released.
But then it should be in the spring.
So it is because of the fact that it is celebrated by the non-Jewish world. This eight-day period, that's the release of these forces. It's not because of his birth, it's because of the celebration. And therefore, you'll see that in the Jews that lived in the Ukraine and the Jews that lived in Russia, and the Jews that lived in other Slavic areas did not learn on the night of January 5th to 6th. And the Jews that lived in Poland, which is a Roman Catholic country, did not learn the night of 24 to 25 of December. And then there were those that, as always, there are those that want to take care of all ends possible, so they didn't learn the two nights. But they got up at midnight in order to study. Now, associated with this are great questions that are raised in halacha. For instance, there are Jewish artisans who are experts in certain fields of decoration. I knew a man in New York, a wonderful Orthodox Jew, who was the world, one of the leading art framers in the world. You know, like when you buy a Rembrandt for $8 million, you don't go to Woolworth and buy a 25-cent frame, right? So the frame can cost $200,000. I've been in his showroom and his factory. He's got frames there that are worth $400,000 or $500,000. He frames for all the great museums in the world, art museums, for the great art collectors. He framed for Nelson Rockefeller, for the Shah of Iran when he was around. You know, it's like so. And one of his great talents is gold leafing. They roll out gold to the thickness, even thinner than aluminum foil, and then they put the gold leaf on the frame, on whatever they want, and it radiates the color of gold and the brightness of it, etc. In the United States, in Manhattan, on the corner of 67th and Lexington. There was a church called St. Peter's, which was an Episcopalian church, one of the oldest in New York. And Citibank, Citicorp, purchased the lot, big lot, and they built up this enormous skyscraper. But then the question arose, what do you do with the church? And so they built a new church on a corner of the lot. Citicorp did it with your money. And the church is there. Now, when they were dedicating the church, they wanted the gold leaf, the altar in the church. So they came to this man, and they said to him, you know, you're the world's greatest expert in gold leaf. We want you to gold leaf the altar of the church. Now, this is an old, old dilemma for Jews. Because on one hand, why should he gold leaf the altar of the church, which many hold to be at least close to paganism? On the other hand, by saying no, you run the problem of incurring added enmity. And especially in a society, let's say, like the United States, where everybody's the same, right? There are no differences in any of the religions. Everything is the same. You know, you're okay, I'm okay, they're okay, and nothing, no problems. So then it's hard to, how do you say no? Now, this is raised in the 12th century. In the 12th century, Jews were stained glass guys. There's no field of endeavor that the Jews have not enriched from the beginning of time until today. Because the Lord promised our father Abraham, and he repeated the promise to Yitzchak, and he repeated it to Yaakov, v'nivrechu b'cho kol mishpachos ol adamo. Through you, all of mankind will be blessed. So 30% of the Nobel Prize winners are Jewish, even though the Jews are less than a quarter of 1% of the world population. I mean, you got to stop and think about that. And the awarding of the Nobel Prize to Jews is not because they like Jews. They're not going out of their way to, you know. But the Jewish nature has been to enrich all of mankind. And that's true in the arts as well. I mean, music, art, there's no field of endeavor where the Jews are not very disproportionately represented. So one would think that that fact alone should make Jews stop and think a little. You don't have to put on a shtreimel, just think a little. How come? Why don't the Japanese have Nobel Prize winners? I mean, they got only Sony, but why don't they, you know? Why? Well, how come? So, in the Middle Ages, Jews were experts in stained glass. And all of the churches went to stained glass windows. So then the question arose, and the stained glass windows many times had actual representations of not just of the crucifixion, of crosses, of Jesus, of Mary, of, you know. I don't know if you've ever been in the Vatican. I was in there once. You know, it's like unbelievable. Unbelievable. So the Vatican has all of its artwork priced at $1, its value for insurance purposes, because it's priceless, right? How can you value, you know, Michelangelo's ceiling or Bernini's gates? So it's just, you know, but a lot of the art in the Vatican is Jewish, was performed by Jews. Who were contracted by the Pope and who you know, worked on it, helped do it. And so, therefore, all of this question arose, you know, you're allowed to do it or not. So the my friend went and asked his rabbi, who said, if you can get out of it, get out of it. And so what he did is he put in a bid at such an astronomical price that the church found somebody else to do it. But what would have happened if the church would have been willing to pay the price? That's a different matter. But in any event, but that's a problem that has always arisen. So the question is, for instance, can you sell Christmas trees or Christmas decorations? Or there are many department stores in the world, commercial stores in the world, owned by Jews. And again, all of that comes under this heading, this question. So there are bad Jewish jokes about it. But the truth is, for instance, there was an article not long ago in the Jerusalem Post that all of the vendors outside of the Vatican, outside St. Peter's in the Vatican, all the vendors are Jewish, who sell you the postcards and the crucifixes and the holy water, and they're all Jewish. And it's been controlled by Jews for 300 years. And the stalls are given over by inheritance from the father to the son. And the Vatican recognizes only them as having the right to sell. And they're all Jews. And those that are Shomrei Shabbat, so then on Saturday they have non-Jews that operate the stalls for them. What was the origin of this crazy thing? Is because of the fact that Sunday was the biggest day, and Sunday the Vatican didn't want that the Catholics should work. It was a time when Sunday was also a day of rest in the world, before we got to 7-day, 24-hour shopping, and, you know, no day of rest, period. So they had to have Jews on Sunday. And when they had to have Jews on Sunday, so then Jews came back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday also. And that became their, really their license from the Vatican to sell all of these things. Which, if you think about it, is, you know, pretty strange. But the whole world is strange, so it doesn't make a difference. So what about selling all of these items for Christmas? So that's also discussed by the rabbis. Basically, it was allowed because of the fact that the rabbis were always aware that we were a very small minority amongst a sea of Christians who were raised, especially in Europe, and we see that even today. Just the anti-Semitism is like baked into their blood, even if they never saw a Jew anymore. I mean, you have generations of Poles that have never seen a Jew. When you go to Poland, it's they'll Heil Hitler you on the street.
Are you exaggerating the sake of the fact?
It happened to me. I was in a car in Warsaw, and another car pulled up next to me with four teenagers in it, young people in it, and they rolled down the window and they Heil Hitler, as though 3 million Poles weren't killed by the Germans. So it's a fact, it's not it's one of my reasons why I'm not interested to support Eastern European countries with my tourist dollars. I'm going to go somewhere, there are nicer places in the world and nicer people. But because of the fact that Jews lived under those conditions, the rabbis were always very hesitant to limit the commerce. I'll give you another example. In Poland, for instance, the Jews were the ones that who had the stores open on Sunday. People then, you didn't go shopping the way we go shopping now. You know, you go once a week or once a month and you fill up the freezer and the refrigerator, and you know, you don't have to go shopping every day. But I remember yet as a child when I grew up sometime after the American Civil War that you certainly have to go shopping every day. And therefore, if Sunday all the stores were closed, so then nobody could buy bread, milk, nothing. So the Jews were the ones that had the stores open on Sunday. One of the great anti-Semitic decrees of the Polish government in the 1930s was to force the Jews to close on Sunday, so they were closed on Saturday and they were closed on Sunday, which took away a great deal of their earning power. So, but that became, the Jews, so to speak, became the suppliers of these things to the church. And that was one of the ways that the Jews later were able to commercialize the Christian holiday of Christmas. The whole idea of trees, for instance, doesn't start till 1850 in England. And most of what goes on today, Santa Claus and holly and mistletoe and snow and everything else, that's all, you know, recent inventions, right? Because the early Christians were unaware of any of this, and it had no religious significance whatsoever. But this became part of this great commercial venture. And the commercial venture has a life of its own. And therefore, the rabbis not only, I don't think, did not prohibit it, I don't think they could have prohibited it, even if they wanted to. I don't think that the rabbis were always careful not to make decrees that were unenforceable, not to give rules that could not be followed or would not be followed, because there's nothing that undermines one's authority as much as decreeing something and not following up on it, not being able to enforce it. If you're ever a teacher in a classroom, that's the first lesson to learn, because if you don't enforce it, then you know, you lost control completely. So they were very hesitant, very careful about it. In my time, when I went to school, so first of all, I went to public school. There was no Jewish school in Chicago until I reached seventh grade, and then I went into the Jewish school, and then I went into the yeshiva. But the first, until seventh grade, I was in the American public school system. In the American public school system, the school that I went to was 98% Jewish, both the teachers and the students. But Christmas was a big yontiv by us. We all sang Christmas carols, and it was it had a tree, and it was all, you know, the ACLU didn't get to separation of church and state then.
We still haven't.
And that was all part of it. My friend, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, the noted psychiatrist, and they were one of the world's great experts on substance abuse. He and I were once riding in a car together, and we were in the back seat. In the front seat were two noted Rashi yeshiva, I mean really noted, very, very pious Jews. So Twersky turns to me and he says, Beryl, he said, you and I, we have a great advantage. We went to public school, so we have a good secular education. At that time it was true. I don't know if it's true today any longer, but then it certainly was true. We were reading Chaucer in sixth grade. Now, I said to Tversky, that's right, yes, we went to public school. So one of the great rabbis turned around and he said, I also went to public school. So Tversky looks at him as only Tversky can, and he says, well, if you said you went to public school, you went to public school, then it's certainly not apparent. Then the other man who was driving the car, who was really, you know, way up there, he said, I also went to public school. So Tversky says, I don't believe you. He said, I'm telling you, I went to public school. Tversky says, prove it. Sing Silent Night. Because if you went to public school, you could sing Silent Night. Everybody could sing it. And that was part of the American culture. It was part of the general culture. And it affected Jews all over the place. So you have, today in the United States, you have, what do they call it, Chris Hanukkah or something, you know? Yeah, right? It's one holiday, right? Became, you know, that's it. Everybody is even.
Multicultural.
Right, but that is really... to a great extent, a Jewish invention. Yeah, well, that's so the blacks imitated, right? The blacks also want to have their holiday, so they created their holiday. But again, if you look at it, it really is very strange, because the United States today has a population of 275 million, if not more, and there are about 5 million Jews, maybe. So why it should get equal play to, you know, the president should light a Hanukkah menorah, which he does, and why it should get equal play to, is really, it's an astounding thing, right? There are more Native Americans in the United States, and many more Muslims, and all sorts of other groups, right? And, you know, it doesn't happen. And by us it happens. So that's all part of the of how Jews came to view it. And for a long time here in Israel, there was no Christmas. I remember that when I first came to, first visited Israel in 1967, so I came in late November and early December. And when I flew back to the United States and I got off the plane at Kennedy Airport, and there it was all Christmas decorations already, it struck me for the first time what this season looks like in the absence of Christmas. However, that has changed because of a number of factors. First of all, there are hundreds of thousands of non-Jewish Russians who have come into the country and who celebrate Christmas, though most of them celebrate it in January, not now. Secondly, you have tens of thousands of foreign workers in the country, and many of them are Christians. The number of Christian Arabs has declined precipitously because of the behavior of the Muslim Arabs towards them. So if you want to meet the Christian Arabs of Bethlehem, there once were over 35,000. Today there's less than 15,000. If you want to meet them, you have to go to Santiago, Chile, because that's where they left for. But because of these Russian non-Jews and the foreign workers, and also because of Christian tourism, which is a vital element. There were over 30,000 tourists that went to Bethlehem on the night of December 24th. All 30,000 had to land here at Ben-Gurion. And they're basically based in Israel. And tourism is a vital part of our economy. It's one of the top three. It's diamonds, high tech, and tourism are the top three. agriculture has slipped down already, as you can't really compete with the wages being paid in Morocco or in Thailand, etc. But in tourism, it's still, this is the holy city, this is the holy land, it's the only place to come. And therefore, there's an appeal to Christianity to come here, a commercial appeal for them to come here. So the city of Jerusalem has certain streets that are decorated with lights, and the city of Jerusalem provides free Christmas trees. And Christmas is here. Now, again, this is an extension of what I've discussed before. We live in a very tough world. We have very few friends. Even our friends are not really our friends. And therefore, we're not looking to antagonize people. And to say, as somebody would say, well, you know, we shouldn't have any of this, and we shouldn't provide for them, etc., is really, whistling in the dark. You're really missing the whole point, because we have almost no choice. And therefore, it is always a question of how a minority adjusts to a majority culture, to a majority faith. And the only way the minority can really adjust is by having a self-identity, by having self-pride, by somehow feeling that I'm able to do it myself. And the famous verse in the Novi that each and every nation will go in the name of their God, but that the Jewish people will continue to go in the name of the eternal God, who is the universal God of all. Well, that pretty much sums up our relationship to Christianity and to Islam also, to all faiths. It's one of a tolerance but distance. And we so to speak, have made necessary adjustments in order that we should be able to survive and prosper. Again, as this small minority in this great sea of people of different faiths and of different beliefs, and who many times have been very inimical to us. Thanks for coming, and have a very happy Hanukkah.